The purpose of this forum is to discuss what the Bush administration's current justification is for the war in Iraq, which is regime change. It seems to me this concept seems to mean, first, remove Saddam Hussein, second, remove other leaders of the government and the Ba'ath Party, three, bring political democracy, four, institute neoliberal reforms by dismantling the Iraqi state institutions such as the state oil corporations and replacing with private American corporations, presumably, and giving over other public functions to private companies. While we, as historians, we want to enter into this discussion, one of the things we want to convince you is that history is relevant, and it's useful to look back to try to look forward. But we don't pretend to know what is going to happen in the future. We don't share the certitude of many of Bush's advisors. So what we can do is contribute, maybe give cautionary tales about the lessons of the United States' past experiences with regime change. And we have two centuries of experiences, so we have a lot to draw on. But we understand, I hope I'm speaking for everyone, that history is often like a bucking bronco. It follows a convoluted path. It makes fools of the most arrogant. So we don't really know exactly where to go. U.S. past experiences have been historically contingent, that is, chance plays a large role, and they're not just obedient to logic. The nature of the U.S. experiences has changed over time and place, and even in the same place, the U.S. experiences have been different at different times. So there are a lot of variables to keep in mind. The U.S. acted quite differently with defeated superpowers Japan and Germany, on whom we lavished much money, as opposed to, say, Guatemala or Haiti, where we had regime changes not followed with very much aid. So, you know, there is no set one-size-fits-all U.S. policy in terms of regime change. Changes over time. But one thing that does happen almost always is, and something we need to be wary of, is the law of unintended consequences. We just can't be sure. Santana is often quoted that those who don't learn from the past are bound to repeat it, which is a nice quote, but we still have to ask, what is it we should learn from the past, and what will be repeated? This is, of course, something we're going to leave for you to decide. We certainly don't know. Now, setting aside the moral and legal questions about the more than 100,000 U.S. troops who are now in Iraq, and not even sure what to call them, we're not supposed to call them occupiers, but they certainly aren't guest workers. Anyway, putting aside that, we're not going to talk about whether they should be there. We want to consider whether this is likely to spur an outbreak of peace, democratization, and modernization, as the authors of the Roadmap to the Middle East Peace promise, and of course, we all hope that that's right, or is it more likely going to be like the headline of the LA Times yesterday, which said that the U.S. is struggling in a quicksand in Iraq? Are we building the foundations of a peaceful, just order? Or are we, as Pete Seeger said of another war, neck deep in the big muddy? We're not only going to be asking, we will mostly, our panelists, consider U.S. past experiences abroad, but we also keep in mind, what were the effects at home? What did it mean for people in the United States to be involved in these various efforts? The presentations are all going to be short. I've said 10 minutes. I don't know how successful I'm going to be. But if I appear rude, it's because I said 10 minutes. And then we want to open it up, because we look at this as kind of a general discussion, and we will invite you all to ask questions or present your opinions. So we're going to go kind of roughly in chronological order. We're going to start with Cuba, because the United States regime change practices began close to home. Started in Latin America, and we're fortunate to have Bob Duncan, Professor Duncan, with us, who is teaching a course on U.S. interventions in Latin America this quarter, has articles in some of the most prestigious journals in Latin American history, and will be having a book on one of the early regime change efforts in Latin America, not by the United States in his case, but actually the French in Mexico under Maximilian. So first, Bob Duncan.
Thank you. I would like to start with a story. Just about a month ago, my six-year-old daughter was getting ready for school, and she saw the pictures of the statue of Saddam Hussein being pulled down in Baghdad. And for a six-year-old, that was really funny, seeing the torso pulled off from the legs. So about 2 weeks ago, she asked me whether or not they had put another statue up to take the place of it. So I told her, well, probably not. They probably won't put another statue up for quite a while. She thought for a moment and said, what about George Bush? While I could have explained why a bronze statue of our 43rd president in downtown Baghdad was not a very good idea, I just told her, well, that's a thought. But it got me thinking about the many times in inter-American relations that the U.S. was directly involved in some form of regime change in Latin America. Therefore, I'd like to turn briefly, since we only have a few minutes, to a time just over 100 years ago when the U.S. occupation forces in Cuba faced a similar challenge as we do today in constructing a new regime. My focus will be on a couple key features, the promotion of democracy and elections. Like Operation Iraqi Freedom, the Spanish-American War was a short and popular conflict that resulted in the military occupation of Cuba from 1898 to 1902. Actually, the war had derailed a 30-year liberation struggle by the Cuban people themselves. But as a victor, the U.S. military government directly controlled the course of regime change. The goal was simple. The U.S. looked to set up a stable regime that would protect U.S. interests in Cuba. As Governor General Leonard Wood explained to President McKinley, when people ask me what I mean by stable government, I tell them money at 6%. Representative democracy, though free through free elections, seemed the best way to prevent political chaos and stave off a social revolution. During the initial phases of the occupation, the military government simply appointed conservative Cuban exiles in the U.S. to fill public offices and administrative positions. From the U.S. point of view, these exiles were trustworthy since they spoke English, always a good thing, frequently attended U.S. schools, and most importantly, they had American values. Immediately following the war, Cuban exiles flooded their homeland to take advantage of the new opportunities that seemed to be present, whether or not they had even supported the struggle for independence. A major question facing the U.S. administration, however, was whether a democratic system could be established in a country without democratic traditions. Echoes of this can still be heard today when people talk about Iraq. Real doubts existed ever since the time of John Quincy Adams, whether Cubans or Latin Americans in general were capable of self-government. In fact, the resistance that some Cubans showed to U.S. occupation forces seemed ample proof that for most of the people at the time that Cubans were incapable of self-governance. Nevertheless, elections would have to be held since they served an important purpose. They served the purpose of being an exit strategy for U.S. troops. The mechanics of setting up an electoral system were easy. More troublesome would be what would happen if the wrong people got elected. Universal manhood suffrage in Cuba, it was felt, might swamp the, quote, better classes. So the occupation government tried to stack the deck so that wouldn't happen. A new electoral law restricted voting to those over 20, but more importantly, those that were either literate, had $250 in property, or had served in the army. In this way, U.S. officials reduced the potential electorate in Cuba by two-thirds, the majority of whom were Afro-Cubans. Still, despite vigorous campaigning by General Wood, the municipal and constituent assembly elections in 1900 failed to get the U.S.-favored candidates elected, most likely since most of these people had very little to do with the independence struggle and that had gone on for 30 years. Finally, understanding the need to find candidates with some kind of revolutionary credentials, the U.S. picked Tomas Estrada Palma to run in Cuba's first presidential election in 1902. As head of the Cuban Revolutionary Party, Estrada was a pro-U.S. converted Quaker who had spent his last 30 years in exile. To aid the chances of democratic victory, and I use that term very loosely, occupation officials harassed the opposition candidate to the point where he just withdrew from the election. Thus, Estrada won an uncontested election and without ever leaving his home in upstate New York. He never visited Cuba. He won the presidency of Cuba without ever stepping foot in Cuba to campaign. The U.S. did it for him. The U.S. evacuated its forces following the election, as would become the pattern, only to have Marines then re-embark again in 1906, 1912, and 1917, when corrupt elections forced their return. The Cuban occupation became the standard for the first three decades of the last century as the U.S. tried to solve political problems of Nicaragua, Haiti, Panama, and the Dominican Republic with military force. As the Cubans would find, it was hard to develop a responsible political system when intervention could be used as a political trump card. More often than not, Cuban politicians requested U.S. Marines to help them either maintain power or regain it once they lost it. Whether intended or not, the U.S. became an integral part of Cuban politics, setting the stage for future instability. Ultimately, it begs the question whether external nation building is an inherently destabilizing endeavor in the long run. No statue of McKinley was ever put up in Cuba. But in 1925, a memorial was constructed to those sailors who had died on the USS Maine that was sunk in Havana Harbor. In 1961, Fidel Castro added an inscription to the memorial. He added, "To the victims of the Maine, who were sacrificed by imperialist greed in its mission to conquer the island of Cuba." Hopefully, a similar inscription won't appear in downtown Baghdad. Okay.
Next, we have the pleasure of having Professor Lynn Malley, who is another one of our distinguished faculty. Lynn is a historian of the Soviet Union, or started as a historian of the Soviet Union. Now she's a historian of many different countries, particularly working on during what we used to call the Russian Revolution, cultural issues. And she's going to talk to us about the Soviet Union and Russia and maybe other parts of the former evil empire. Lynn.
Well, Steve took away one of my lines, which is that I hope you all know that the original evil empire is the Soviet Union. It's not Iraq or North Korea or anything else. It's the Soviet Union. The United States has a very stormy relationship with the Soviet Union, now Russia and many other countries. Since the Russian Revolution of 1917, our first foray into internal Russian affairs was the invasion of Russia in the Russian Civil War in 1919-1920, when very briefly, very few troops, ineffectively tried to invade Siberia. We came through Siberia, other countries, France and Britain invaded other countries, other parts of the country. And this had the effect of actually rallying people around the Russian Revolution and certainly helping to bring the Bolsheviks to power. So, or allowing them to stay in power. So there is one example of an intervention that went really wrong. The United States and the Soviet Union were allies in the Second World War, but after the war was over, or indeed while the war was starting, they became very bitter enemies and waged the Cold War, the confrontation that lasted from 1944-45 until the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. The United States' goal was to change the behavior of the Soviet Union if that was possible, and if that wasn't possible, to try to bring down the Soviet Union. And we were fairly effective in that process eventually under the Reagan administration by spending more and more money on arms, money that the Soviet Union couldn't match. And eventually the system fell apart. There are some people who argue that this is the reason for the fall of the Soviet system, the fact that the United States was so willing to throw money at bringing it down. It's not my personal view. I think the Soviet system actually fell apart pretty much on its own. But the confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union was certainly a factor, a big factor, in overburdening the Soviet system to the point where it simply collapsed. Now, here is the paradox. By the time the Soviet Union collapsed, people no longer believed Soviet propaganda, which said that the United States was an evil country, it wasn't democratic, it was racist, there was huge wage differentials, had a gigantic underclass that lived in squalor, and all the rest of it. The Soviet population did not believe this propaganda. And in fact, most people admired the United States, because it was the enemy of a government that they no longer respected. Here's the second paradox. Today in Russia and the successor states of the Soviet Union, there are 15 of them, with very few exceptions, maybe the small Baltic republics, the United States is extremely unpopular in the Soviet Union, very unpopular. The Russian population with very high percentages, opposed America's war in Iraq and believes that the United States is out for world domination and out to wrest any sense of pride and accomplishment that Russia and the post-Soviet regimes have. So why this turnaround? When we were enemies, they liked us, and now when we're friends, they don't like us. What happened? I don't know all the answers, but I'll give you some answers and then talk a little bit about the consequences that I see within the former Soviet Union. First of all, the United States was a very poor winner. This is a nasty quality. When you win, you should be gracious. You should not go around dancing on the other people's misfortune. But the United States has not accomplished this. The most recent example a few weeks back was when Rumsfeld said that we have defeated Saddam Hussein, who is one of the world's worst dictators, like Lenin. Well, the Russians don't all think that Lenin was one of the world's worst dictators, and they certainly don't think that he belongs in the same category as Hitler, which is where Rumsfeld put him. So the whole notion, Rumsfeld was essentially saying that the whole notion of the Russian Revolution and what happened under the Russian Revolution was a terrible mistake. The United States has also continued with NATO, an organization that was created to guard against the expansion of the Soviet Union, a country which no longer exists. It has gathered into NATO not only the people that were in it before, but all of the Eastern European countries that really hate Russia and the Soviet Union, perhaps with good cause, but from the Russians' point of view, this looks like a very threatening alliance against it at a time when it's certainly, as far as Russians are concerned, they are certainly in no condition to become an aggressive power. In addition, the United States and NATO has expanded into older areas of Soviet influence, Russian influence, and Russian control. The example that many Russians will give you is the example of Serbia. Serbia is a very old Russian ally. Russia, the Russian Empire, before the Russian Revolution, was responsible for creating and protecting Serbia and Bulgaria and countries in that area. And the bombing of Belgrade was probably one of the most detrimental acts that the United States has done recently to turn Russian opinion against the United States. To us, it looked like liberation. To the Russians, perhaps, it looked like liberation. To the Russians, it looked like nothing but imperialism, a vicious attack on an ally that was done to undermine their credibility and their ability, perhaps, to bring about a compromise. All of this, these threats to the Soviet Union's sense of security, has brought about in Russia, I think, the absolute opposite of democracy. Of course, the Soviet Union, the Russia has political parties, but they are largely poorly functioning. And mainly, it has at its center a imperial presidency, the likes of which the world has never seen. Under Yeltsin, perhaps that wasn't so threatening because he was so incompetent. But Putin is a very, very competent man. So we have at the head of the former Soviet Union, not a Democrat, but a former KGB agent who is gaining more power and influence by the day. We have, in my opinion, missed a golden opportunity to really make friends with the former Soviet Union. Instead, relations between the United States are getting and Russia and most of the Russian republics are getting worse, are very unstable. And I would like you to consider the following. We have talked about chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and we haven't been able to find any. But you could probably kick a fire hydrant in Russia and find weapons of mass destruction. They are everywhere. So we have alienated a country that really poses a potential threat to peace and security in the world.
Thanks, Lynn. And now we have, in our cavalcade of distinguished historians, also the chair of the history department, Kim Pomerantz, a specialist in China and world history, who will talk about China, not surprisingly.
When Steve asked me to do this, I hesitated at first because China is actually a country in which the United States has never, at least successfully, sponsored a regime change. And I was trying to think what I was doing up here. And then I remembered about 3 years ago, I published a fairly obscure paper that was called Rethinking 18th Century China. And shortly after, got a phone call from Langley, Virginia, from a guy who turned out to work for the CIA, who was very interested in this paper. Now, as it turned out, this was all supposed to be background for some paper on Chinese resources and so on and so forth. But I was very struck that when I mentioned this to a friend of mine, his first response was, "Oh my God, they've solved time travel and they're going to destabilize the Qing." In spite of that rather remote possibility, the U.S.'s first really extensive involvement with the highest levels of politics in China dates from the 1930s. There was some American role in China going back to the 1840s, but it's in the 1930s that the United States becomes very closely involved in the politics of the nationalist government. And our goal at that time was really quite simple. The nationalists were engaged in a war with Japan. They were keeping 1.5 million Japanese troops tied down. And especially after Pearl Harbor, the United States was very eager for them to continue keeping 1.5 million Japanese troops tied down. Consequently, we wanted to do what we could to strengthen this ally. The problem was that this was an exceedingly unpopular regime, and also, in many ways, a very corrupt regime. And the U.S. had serious difficulties in trying to get its aid to be used effectively, in part because the nationalists, well aware that the end of the war against Japan, assuming it was successful, was likely to be followed by a showdown with the communists for control of the country, were husbanding their resources, preferring not to use their best troops against the Japanese, preferring to build up and save their troops for a future confrontation with the communists. The U.S. found this rather frustrating, found the pace of reform rather extremely slow, and periodically would threaten
to cut off its aid to the nationalists if they didn't shape up. The nationalists would then sort of sigh and say, gee, well, you know, if you cut off our aid, I could see why you'd do that. But unfortunately, then we'd collapse and those 1.5 million Japanese troops would be free to fight elsewhere. As a journalist at the time put it, the United States kept threatening to cut the nationalist throat and the nationalists kept threatening to die. And I think this actually illustrates a point that goes well beyond the Chinese case, which is that it looks very easy at first to find a client regime that seems favorably oriented towards you, or at least with whom you have certain common interests, and to say, well, we're not going to worry that much about the fact that they don't have strong popular support or that they have certain unsavory characteristics. We can work with them. And, you know, after all, it's in their interest to shape up too. We'll give them the means and we'll show them how. What that frequently ignores is that these regimes often do the things that make them unpopular for reasons that are very hard to change. And once you are visibly identified with them, or once you have chosen them as your instrument for accomplishing some goal, the fact that they are weak doesn't necessarily give you the leverage over them that you might think. They have the strength of weakness, because you can't remove your assistance without them toppling. And in many ways, you find that being strong means you have less leverage, not more. And this is, of course, a lesson that the United States, you would think, would have learned from many subsequent cases as well, but seems not to have. The second lesson that this example would illustrate, if I had the time to flesh it out, is that who you choose to work with can have long-lasting consequences. In the case of the nationalists, the two agencies we were most interested in helping to shape up were the army, of course, but Chiang Kai-shek kept a rather tight rein on the army and didn't allow us to do very much to improve its performance, and the police, especially the political police, or as most people call them, the secret police. The U.S. sent a mission organized by the FBI to help Chinese police reform. Their contact there was a man named Dai Li, who went by the not-too-enviable nickname of China's Himmler. And we worked, indeed, quite closely with him to try and shape up the nationalist secret police, which included instructing them in techniques of interrogation, techniques of data collection and maintenance, so on and so forth, things that they, of course, were then perfectly free to use for whatever ends they wanted. Moreover, when you work with elements like that in the security apparatus, these people tend to stay in the pipeline a long time after you're done with them. Long after the nationalist regime was gone from the mainland, having relocated to Taiwan, even long after many of the more unsavory elements of the nationalist regime had been cleaned up, many of the people we had instructed in, you know, techniques of kidnapping and interrogation and so on and so forth were still bouncing around the world. In fact, Fred Wakeman up at Berkeley, who wrote a really wonderful book several years ago about the American involvement with Chinese police, loves to tell the story of how one morning in the early 1980s, he's sitting there reading his New York Times, and there's a story about people smuggling guns to Libya. And who turns up except these people he knows from his research, who 35 years earlier we had employed and taught various things about gun running. You know, once you have that skill, it's a very well-paid skill, and you may well stick with it for years to come. The third thing that I think is illustrated by this period is that, and this is something that's come up, I think, particularly in Bob's talk a minute ago, is that you may think of yourself as a liberator, even quite sincerely. It doesn't always look that way to the people on the ground.
in 1945, at the end of the war with Japan, American troops played a role in receiving the Japanese surrender in China, where, of course, there were still a million troops at the end of the war. We played a crucial role in deciding who they would surrender to, i.e., who got their equipment. We informed them at certain cities not to surrender until the proper people came to accept their surrender. In other words, don't surrender to the communists if they got there first, which led to the unfortunate position of incredibly hated Japanese troops and police remaining on duty on instructions from the Americans. This did not do us any good. Shortly thereafter, in a widely publicized incident, an American Marine raped a Chinese woman in Beijing. You have enough troops there, something will happen. From an American perspective, they might have said, well, we defeated Japan for you. Come on, one thing like this, how much does this weigh against the contribution we have made to your freedom? The Chinese understandably didn't see it that way and saw this crime and the fact that under extraterritoriality, the Americans insisted this Marine couldn't be subject to Chinese justice as a sufficient insult to help discredit our allies of the time, the nationalists. Certainly not the most important factor, but not a trivial one. The last thing I want to say about this period in the 40s is that one of their most unfortunate consequences was a consequence for the United States. Throughout the war, the U.S. government and the U.S. press was very reluctant to tell the truth about the problems with our Chinese ally. On the contrary, Chiang Kai-shek and so forth were played up as great heroes. Their popularity was greatly exaggerated in the American press, Time magazine being the principal villains in this matter. Many Americans believed these folks were extremely popular. At the end of the war, they had a far larger army than the communists. They seemed in every way poised to win the struggle for control. And of course, they didn't. And when they didn't, from the American point of view, it seemed to happen suddenly, surprisingly, and it led to a search for what went wrong. And through much of the 1950s, one heard the refrain of who lost China, ignoring, of course, the fact that it had never been ours to lose. But a pattern of deception and putting the best face on things then led to an inability to face reality, and instead led to a hunt for scapegoats that played no small role in the growth of McCarthyism and some of the worst incidents in the history of American civil liberties. It took many, many years to get beyond that. It really took until, in some ways, until Nixon's visit to China in 1971, and in certain ways, probably anybody but Nixon would have been unable to get out of that because people like Richard Nixon never would have let them forget it. Just two very brief points before I quit. One is that the U.S. also has an unfortunate pattern with China, as with some other countries, of trying to put pressure on unfriendly regimes in a way that often just winds up radicalizing them. The American escalation in Korea and the push to the border of China before being pushed back played a significant role in radicalizing Chinese politics in the early 50s. It is debated, but some people would argue that the American escalation in Vietnam in 1965 played a significant role in at least the timing, if nothing else, of the Cultural Revolution. More recently, in incidents that have some resonance with some of the things Lynn talked about, American attempts to pressure China have often backfired by making it impossible for the Chinese government to make concessions to the United States and instead rallying people around the hardliners. And that brings me to the very last thing I wanted to talk about just really briefly, which are some of the ways that the American role in the Middle East looks to the Chinese. And fundamentally, the Chinese have never been able to believe, I think, that this isn't above all about political domination and about oil. And the Chinese, who will likely be the world's largest oil importers by about 2020, find this quite alarming. There has been a steady drumbeat of policy papers coming forth from China in the last several years about what it means to be dependent on the global economy for markets and also for crucial resources, and whether this is a good idea from a security point of view, and whether they have not in some ways made themselves dangerously vulnerable. Not surprisingly, hardliners, particularly in the military, are the ones who really want to push the point of view that this kind of global interdependence is scary, we want to step back, we want to be more self-reliant again, things that should worry us. The American move into Iraq and the fact that for the foreseeable future, the largest source of oil in the world is going to be a spigot that the United States Navy can turn on or turn off, scares the heck out of these people. And they don't always respond very well to being scared. And to the extent that they're scared and they don't respond well, that's something that should probably scare us too.
I really hadn't intended for the forum to be to scare you. I mean, I think we have enough people in Washington working full time at that that we don't need to contribute. But I think so far presentations, even as Ken says, United States didn't have much to do with China, clearly did. But also the obverse is clear that our efforts abroad have had substantial impact on the United States, on our budget, on our politics. So there's a regime shaping going on both sides. One of the instances that's most talked about, one of the examples that people use or misuse and discuss the most, is Vietnam. Unfortunately, we have an expert on Vietnam, Charles Wheeler, who is going to discuss very briefly something which would take him much longer, but I hope afterwards in the questions and answers he'll have an opportunity to talk more about that. He's going to discuss the United States' experience in Vietnam.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, there's so much to say about Vietnam. Fortunately, Ken helped me out a bit because I think many of the things that he said about the U.S. About the U.S. approach to the Chinese Civil War, I think could easily be taken and transplanted to Vietnam. We can change Republic of China to Republic of Vietnam and switch one type of communist for another, and we see many of, and you'll find many of the same issues. Perhaps we can take out the business about the press. The situation is different in the 40s and the 50s. But one of the things I think is that's interesting to me about about what shaped American leadership during this period and what motivated them to get the U.S. militarily involved in Vietnam had a lot to do with the loss of China. This was something that Lyndon Johnson repeatedly worried about in his anguish over whether to commit American troops into Vietnam. I think, and Lynn brought up an interesting point, that Americans make poor winners. I think Vietnam shows that Americans make poor losers as well. So it puts us in a bit of a bind. I'm just going to touch on a few points that I hope we can chew on in discussion. But first of all, I want to start off by clarifying something that I think needs clarification with regards to Vietnam. And that is that it's something that I thought a lot about since 9/11, when the word Vietnam comes up appears and then disappears, resurges again. And that is that we have to remember that I think for Americans, Vietnam really is a kind of idea. It's Vietnam for Americans. And I mean, and I think this is true for those who feel strong, who felt or feel strongly against the war as just as much as those who supported it, that it's Vietnam has always been a kind of a muse for us, a kind of backdrop for an American drama. We rarely think about what about the Vietnam War in any sort of Vietnamese context. Vietnam is the bad war to World War II, the good war, which again gets us into trouble because during the 1960s, when as in the in the 21st century, when we argued over precedence, those who argued over Vietnam looked to World War II, forgetting that most of the military leadership in Vietnam at the time were shaped not by World War II but by Korea, a war that saw casualties on exactly the same, almost exactly the same level as Vietnam. 53,000 American soldiers died in that war, and yet that one seems to have disappeared from our imagination. I find that very interesting and troubling. The other problem is that with Vietnam, as opposed to some of these other cases, we're not, well, I keep asking myself, are we really talking about regime change? I mean, the goal of the United States when it got its, when it committed itself to Vietnam was not regime change, but regime preservation. In other words, the aims of the United States were to aid in the development of democratic, of a democratic alternative to the communist government led by or symbolized by Ho Chi Minh, and not to change a regime. I mean, remember the aims of the United States during the war were not to overturn the communist regime in the North, although there were hawkish critics who have never ended their berating of the U.S. for not doing this. But the aim of the United States was containment. It was the fulfilling of George Kennan's policy, recently nullified, to draw a line in the sand against a larger conspiracy. Just as George Bush recently said that Iraq is a single battle in a greater war, it's not the war itself. Vietnam was a single battle in a larger crusade against Lin's evil empire, and or even more fundamentally, a worldwide communist conspiracy. The other problem with Vietnam is that, and I run into this when I teach the class. What's always interesting to me is the widespread and deeply held belief among students who are children of Vietnam veterans or those who remember the war, and that is that we lost the war. George Bush Sr. said in 1991 that he declared with victory in Iraq the first time, he declared the Vietnam syndrome, that the United States had won a victory over the Vietnam syndrome. In a sense, this Vietnam syndrome, I think, represents essentially a loss. But when Richard Nixon announced the final withdrawal of American troops in 1973, he declared a victory. He had declared a victory because the United States had won a, quote, peace with honor, something that some of the older folks in the crowd, I'm sure, remember. So was this a war that we won or we lost? I find that a rather curious thing. But it really gets down, I think, to this issue of what Vietnam means in American society, and what we believe about the war, which I think is largely is now fraught with myth. So I'll throw out a couple assertions, things that I hear every time I teach a class on the Vietnam War, and I'm largely unsuccessful in dispelling because they're so deeply ingrained among the younger generation. First of all, this idea that Vietnam was after the Vietnam War was a war that the United States lost, that Vietnam was a, quote, quagmire. It represented a loss of innocence for the United States. Of course, that gets confusing. That confuses students a little bit now after 9/11 because 9/11 was declared to be the moment of our loss of innocence. But apparently we lost our innocence before. There's some personal analogies I can make, but I'm not going to. The point I want to make, though, is that we didn't step into the quagmire and lose our innocence in Vietnam either. As far as I know, and maybe Steve or Bob could correct me, these two phrases were coined by Mark Twain, who, again, you know, who now has this sort of country time lemonade folksy image in American society, but is actually was the popular spokesman for the Anti-Imperialist League in beginning in 1898 that opposed McKinley and then later Roosevelt's expansion of U.S. empire in the Caribbean and in the Pacific. Now, and here is where the other point I want to make is that this is where U.S. intervention in Southeast Asia begins. It doesn't begin in 1965. It doesn't begin in 1954 or 1945 when the U.S. found itself shoring up the French efforts to retake Indochina. It goes back to 1898 when the United States committed itself to expanding its political control in Southeast Asia. And the Philippines is, I would argue, well, maybe maybe we got to Cuba first. I guess we did. So I would argue that this is the second prototype for nation building. And much of what Bob said with regard to Cuba in the ways in which the United States overturned, and here we can find a case of regime change, an established Republican government that had already overthrown the Spanish monarchy and the friarocracy in the Philippines before the U.S. Navy and the Marines arrived in the Philippines, after which the United States fought a bloody and now an unwritten war against this Republican movement that cost hundreds of thousands of lives. And it's small wonder that the people of the southern Philippines and many Filipinos throughout the nation are so upset about having U.S. troops on the island of Mindanao, where most of the killing took place. A second example, but this is where this is the prototype for nation building in Southeast Asia begins in the Philippines, and it also begins with a fellow named Ramon Magsaysay, who was placed in office as president of the Philippines after World War II by the CIA, and who turned out to be actually, for the United States, at least as far as the United States was concerned, and actually for many Filipinos, fairly successful. And this never happened, but this often gets bandied about, that Dwight Eisenhower brought Ed Lansdale, the nation builder for Southeast Asia, into his office and said, "Get me another Magsaysay for Vietnam." But that's what he did. He certainly got that message, and that's what he did. And he found his Magsaysay in a man named Ngo Dinh Diem. Now, how this leads to another point, and that's the sort of the concern that has already been raised by Ken, is what do we do about it's all right to overturn one regime, but what do we replace it with, and what do we create in its stead? In 1954, when the French had been soundly defeated at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and had let it be known that it was throwing up its hands and giving up on the reconquest of Indochina, the U.S. could have it if they wanted it, the United States decided to take up the cause in Indochina. After all, since 1948, it had been paying for the war. So it decided, and providing all the hardware and a lot of logistical support, so it decided, well, we might as well get ourselves involved in the government as well. But they needed a leader because the leadership, there was a vacuum in the newly regrouped state of Vietnam centered in Saigon in the south. And they finally found their Magsaysay in this fellow Ngo Dinh Diem, who just happened to be living in the Maryknoll Seminary in New Jersey at the time, and had met a man named William O. Douglas, who was a Supreme Court judge, and was also a member of the Friends of Vietnam. It sounds very like these other groups. What are these? Committee for the New American Century and all. This was a Catholic or an organization of Catholic leaders that included Mike Mansfield, Cardinal John Spellman, and John F. Kennedy. And they had all decided beforehand that this was the man for Vietnam. Ngo Dinh Diem had no experience, political experience. He served as a provincial governor for a few months in 1933. He was tapped as a possible candidate to head the Japanese puppet government in 1945 in Vietnam, but was passed over, after which he, maybe pouting, he was kind of a poutish guy, he left Vietnam and lived in a series of Maryknoll seminaries. He was a devout Catholic. Now, this man was the man who was placed in office, which underscores another point, that there never really was any real democratic election in Vietnam between 1955 and 1975, which leads to another problem, another myth, and that is the aims of the United States was to promote democracy in South Vietnam. In fact, the U.S. aims, if you look at policy statements, are very clear. There were two aims. There was promotion of democracy, but the other one was the promotion of containment, which I already mentioned. But it's clear if you look at the discussions going on in the White House and in various offices of leadership in Washington, that there was one aim that had precedence over another. That is drawing the line in the sand and defeating the communists. And you find in Vietnam several occasions where the two aims come into contradiction. And when push came to shove, when the goals of building democratic institutions in Vietnam contradicted the aims of containment against this larger worldwide communist conspiracy, the United States consistently chose its geopolitical strategy over its ideological aims. We see that, and here's where we get to the one example of regime change with regards to Vietnam. It happened on November 1st, 1963, when a coup led by some junior officers known as the Young Turks in South Vietnam launched a coup against President Ngo Dinh Diem, aimed at removing him from power. Diem tried to escape, he failed, and he and his brother were murdered in a Saigon suburb. The United States, for decades, persistently denied that it had any involvement in this coup. But with, you know, Freedom of Information Act and with time, many people who were involved in the administration at the time finally just forgot they weren't supposed to talk about this. And as people often do, and it became and they made known that in fact the United States was directly involved in the coup against Ngo Dinh Diem. In fact, you can go online if you want. You can send me an email. I'll give you the website. You can hear John F. Kennedy reflecting stating his own regrets on having given the green light to murder Diem 10 days before he was killed himself. It's been released. It's in the Kennedy Library. It's common knowledge now, and it's something that should be known. Now, granted, the man was never democratically elected. He won one election in 1957 with 106.8% of the vote. But and Lansdale said, "Get the percentage down." He insisted that it should be 96.1. And I've always wanted to know why 96.1. A couple other things I'm just going to briefly say because I've already gone over, but I'm just going to throw these out and we can talk about them later. First of all, I think what Ken says about the power of a weak state is an excellent one, and we see several examples of this in Vietnam. The ways in which the South Vietnamese were able to manipulate the negotiations in Paris between 68 and 72 is a is an excellent example. The myth, "If only we had known," popularized by Robert McNamara. I could send you to the archives, and I could show you thousands and thousands and thousands of studies, not just of South Vietnam, but of everything down to the hamlet level, anthropological works, historical works, sociological works, ecological and environmental studies, you name it, it's been done. It was all done by Michigan State University in the 1960s. They had all the information they needed to know in English if they'd wanted it. Second of all, the war was lost by a stab in the back, and this is really important. I'm sorry, Steve, but I have to go over time and mention this because this comes up all the time. And I heard this many times on MSNBC and the Fox Channel. Those damn war protesters, it's going to be the repeat of Vietnam. We're going to lose this because they're going to stab us in the back. Oh, and don't forget the press and the pointy-headed college liberal professors. That phrase actually, as far as I know, was formed by the South Vietnamese who claimed that they had been stabbed in the back by the United States for betraying on all of their promises to the Republican government in 1972 and 3. When Nixon bailed out, he bailed out on the promise to Tu, the solemn promise that the United States would stand tall and proud with the South Vietnamese people. And Kissinger insists this in his other apology about Vietnam recently published, and it's simply untrue. There are plenty. You can go to look at Haldeman's CD of all of his diaries, and you find they had no intentions of following through on it. The other point I want to make is the cost of underestimating the enemy. If you look at this from the U.S. perspective, it's hard to see. But if you look at the war in Vietnam from the perspective of the communist and their nationalist front supporters, it's very clear that what you have here is an excellent example of what can happen when a small group of dedicated individuals with no resources but a commitment to a cause and a savviness for organizational ability and a willingness to learn from setbacks and mistakes. If you go back to the beginnings of the revolution in the 1920s and look at it over the decades, what you see is that it's very easy for such a group to defeat a Goliath. Now, George Bush says that this is not a war against Iraq, that this is a larger war against a kind of shadowy enemy. And it troubles me tremendously to think whatever the wisdom or the justice of the aims of these enemies, whoever they are, I worry about the long-term cost of regime change based on this one precedent. I just want to say about this. I'm going to stop right here. But I think with regards to, I just want to stop with the effect of the war. We talk a lot about chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction. I would like, now, the United States military has already admitted that it used massive amounts of chemical weapons in Vietnam. The people of Vietnam are still suffering from this. About 1,500 to 2,000 men, women, and children are killed every year by unexploded ordnance. That doesn't include Laos, which suffers a much higher percentage, or Cambodia. And these are not mines that have been placed since the war in Vietnam. These are U.S. ordnance that are still buried in fields in Vietnam. And it also severely affected U.S. veterans as well. And I think that's something we should keep in mind. Thank you.